everyone. I'm Haley Allam, and this is Mom Life in Luxembourg. If you're a parent new to Luxembourg, then this is the podcast for you. From crèches to crèmes, we'll cover everything you need to know about raising kids and living your best life in the Grand Duchy. Moin, everyone, and welcome to the show. It is my honor to have the British Ambassador to Luxembourg, Ambassador Joanne Olivier, on the show today. I have to say, this is one of my favorite episodes that I've ever recorded. The ambassador is just an inspiring person. I don't really know how else to say it. It seems like society these days expects us to parent like we don't have a job and work like we don't have kids. What I love about this episode is the ambassador's honesty and candor about how she has been able to do it all, but not at the same time and not without hard work and sacrifice. I also really love how she's motivated by service and genuinely wants to make a positive difference in the world. Our conversation spans from her personal story to her goals for her term here as ambassador, and I found it just fascinating. Please give it a listen and let me know what you think. If you like it, share with a friend or leave me a review on Apple or Spotify. Merci Filmus and enjoy the show. Ambassador Olivier, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for asking me on.
Welcome to the show. I wanted you on for a couple reasons. Obviously, you are the British Ambassador of Luxembourg, so that's amazing. And you've had a really impressive career internationally that resonates with, I think, most of the people who are listening, because we're all living this international life and we've opted in a lot of cases to moving around a lot. So you're like an aspirational, inspirational figure. So I want to say thank you so much. Let's just jump in. Tell me about your Luxembourg story. Did you seek out Luxembourg specifically? Did you get picked? Tell me about how it all came to happen.
With the Foreign Office, we do get to control to some extent where we go, in the sense that you ask for where you want to go, but then you have to compete with all the other people who would love to be ambassador in that location. Luxembourg is a very popular location, so I had to compete to be here. But I did specifically choose Luxembourg. I've been previously posted in Paris and had French training. So it felt like a very good fit with my interests in Europe, and an exciting time to be working in Europe with UK-EU relationships warming up and re-establishing even more closer links. So very much a choice.
Is it like you put your top choices out there and then the Foreign Office puts their top choices out there and then there's a match?
It's quite a complicated system for ambassadors, but yes, there are various boards. You can choose jobs you want to bid on. I only bid for Luxembourg and
really?
Luxembourg. You can play it that way, or you can bid for lots of things and see what you get matched with.
Amazing.
So it just depends.
I'm obviously American. I think that for a lot of the kind of top tier countries, it's a political appointee. But for you, you've been at the Foreign Service for a very long time. So talk to me about that.
The UK system does have that system sometimes of having political appointees. That's usually only for our very biggest posts on certain occasions. But for the most part, all our ambassadors are career diplomats. Have you seen The Diplomat?
Oh, yeah. Is it too soon for me to ask you about that?
That is an example of an American career diplomat who becomes an ambassador. And they make quite a lot of that distinction in the early one or two shows. But in the UK system, that's the norm. Most of our diplomats are career diplomats. I've been in the Foreign Office for 17 years, I think now. Before that, I was a lawyer. So I've had sort of two careers.
Why did you want to go from law to the Foreign Office?
I trained initially as a barrister in the UK, an advocate. I did that for 7 years and I really loved it. The job was absolutely fantastic, really interesting, representing people in court, cross-examining people, that kind of thing. But 7 years in, living in London, traveling every day, only to different courts, I had a travel urge and I wanted to do things on a bigger scale. I wanted to solve conflicts or contribute to solving conflicts on a much bigger scale than just individual humans and their legal wranglings or companies and their legal wranglings. Whereas when you look at geopolitics, those are big strategy questions and issues and relationships between countries was what sort of pulled me more towards the Foreign Office.
I love that.
But there was a blip in between, I should say.
Oh, well, let's hear about the blip.
So I was interested in joining the Foreign Office. I joined the Foreign Office, but it takes a year to get in with all the various things you go through. And in the meantime, I was overseas in Botswana and met my person who'd become my husband. Actually joined the Foreign Office and had to leave for 7 years, special unpaid leave, to follow his career. And so I was a trailing spouse in Botswana for 7 years. And then I rejoined the Foreign Office when my kids were sort of school age, 17 years ago.
So you had joined the Foreign Office, went to Botswana, met your husband, and then had to stop?
Yeah, I took leave to have my young children and follow his career for 7 years. So I rejoined after that.
That's a really common theme. This is my second rodeo abroad. So I lived in Dubai.
I stopped my job to follow my husband, be the trailing spouse. And then I found my feet and ended up being a media director. And that was amazing. But same kind of thing. But was it hard to go back?
While I was in Botswana, like you, I found my feet, as a lot of people do, I think. I went back to law, but in Botswana. I worked for a company as a contract specialist, which needed international legal knowledge rather than very specific Botswana legal knowledge. I also retrained in the evenings under South African law as an international arbitrator. So
wow,
I could bring that to the sort of contract dispute work I was doing. But I worked part-time and I had kids, and Gaborone was a lovely small capital to raise children and work in, as managed doing it all, as they say, for those years when you've got young children.
And you really were doing it all. That I think a lot of lawyers don't want to go through the hassle of getting whatever foreign degree.
Legal jobs are sometimes the least portable if you're going to do sort of court, if you're into sort of court representation. But if you're into big commercial stuff, that can be very portable. It just depends which bit of law you're in.
So were you always very political and internationally minded? Because you went to Botswana by
yourself. Yeah, I guess I always had wider interests and a real travel bug. I love learning about people and how they, what motivates them, different cultures, how humans interact in different cultures and how different societies have developed, what works, what doesn't. So that's really fascinating. The big joy of working for the Foreign Office is you go to a new place and you get to get over time beneath the surface, beyond what you'd see if you're just there on holiday or for a short working visit. And you get to really understand how a country ticks. And for me, that's all about people in the end, but how people relate in a society is fascinating. And then what that brings to the international table is really fascinating.
I've interviewed something like 50 or so people for this podcast, and it's like a common thread, being curious about how other people work and how that all comes to play, different cultures. Everybody here has got that same, I've got the travel bug and I'm committed to living this lifestyle. Have you been able to pull out any themes of how to ground yourself and settle yourself? How many posts have you had abroad?
Lived in Botswana, as I said, privately, and then I've had 3 postings with the Foreign Office, and that's with South Africa, France, and now Luxembourg. Common themes. First of all, I should say there is a major distinction between doing it privately and doing it with the Foreign Office.
The Foreign Office probably helps you out a little bit.
They do help you out quite a bit, but it's also more complicated bureaucratically because there's a lot of protocol issues. Your presence in the country has to be agreed by the host government. So there's a lot of paperwork to work through. But once you're there, things are provided for you and there's a lot more support. Even your belongings being shipped, there are rules about it, but it's done for you. Going to Botswana for the first time, I made some pretty crazy mistakes. So my first private sort of move, I had a young baby of 9 months. So at that point, taking across the world to a place, I didn't even know if they'd have nappies, or in fact, they had periodical gaps in having nappies getting across the border. I didn't know where I'd get formula nappies, that kind of stuff. So I just took so much stuff in the freight. But the first thing is really know the place you're going to so that you know what to take. Definitely a big number one point.
Definitely a big number one point, which is funny because I always think, oh, I'm not going to the moon. Unless there's like a specific, like when I go home, I buy dental floss and this vitamin C that I like. But that's it. Everything else is, yeah, I can manage. But it must have been a really good opportunity for your husband to consider taking a newborn baby to a place where you're not sure if they have diapers.
He knew it. He was from South Africa and he had family in Botswana. So we were actually moving to a place where we had networks and we could very quickly form networks. But I think as a mum, and I guess a lot of people listening to this will be people, families, each of my postings have been a slightly different stage in my kids' development. And each time you have a slightly different kind of approach to it, I think, because when you go as a mum with a small baby, I had a blank calendar. I remember him going off to work the first day and looking at my calendar and thinking, this is surreal. I've just come from working in the Foreign Office and very full calendar. And now I'm looking at sort of an empty calendar. What happens now? I think. And it was a joy just to go to baby groups and meet other mums and other expats from all over the world and just find your tribe. That was easy, I think, actually. People moving with young children, it's quite easy, in a sense, to find your tribe. And whatever trials and tribulations, there would be we didn't have WhatsApp, I think, in those days, but there'd be a sort of a phone call, the nappies have arrived, you could all get to this shop and get your nappies and we'd all trail down there. It's crazy that way. But I think I went to South Africa when the kids were sort of school age, and I think that might have been the most testing thing, because you arrive in a new country, you have a new house, waiting for the new car, the children at a new school, and I've got a new job, you have a new bank account, you have to find the new supermarket, everything is new in one day, and you're expected to turn up for work.
And it was your job.
And it was my job, so it's everything at once.
Tell me about the decision to go back to the Foreign Service.
There is something about when you're younger, you want to make a real dent in the world.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you've read that book, 4,000 Weeks.
I have not.
It's a very good book, but it's like how you should spend your life kind of thing. 4,000 weeks is the average span of human life. I agree with it. I read it about a year ago, but I agree with it, that you can't really make a dent in the universe, most people. So instead of trying to do that, be good while you're here, serve. And I feel that's really important in foreign policy, actually, is I'm not an ambassador to show off or to rake in the gains of a bit of popularity or people being knowing you. You're here to serve. You're absolutely here to serve a purpose. And everyone plays a tiny role in a massive international system. To think that we're not connected, globalization or not, we are connected and everyone plays that role. Keeping that sort of mindset, I think, is quite important in diplomacy.
So how do you serve? And then your philosophy?
You serve on the work side by really understanding the relationship, in this case, between the UK and Luxembourg, and understanding the sort of point in time where we are and what we need, what Luxembourg needs, and understanding where there are opportunities that we can do more together and where we together can contribute to the wider UK-EU relationship or the international world order relationship. So there are loads of areas where UK and Luxembourg are actually very strong partners. So for me, it's a real pleasure because it's like building a bridge, a closer bridge. There are lots of people in the UK who jump for an opportunity to do something with Luxembourg. You just have to bring people together.
Why do people from the UK jump to have an opportunity to do something in Luxembourg?
Luxembourg's innovative and finds lots of interesting niches where it just suddenly excels quickly, like in AI, like in satellites, things like that. The whole world is a kind of a intersection point. So looking for opportunities with innovative, interesting partners who are like-minded, who also have a very international mindset. This is a great moment to find partners who want to do something interesting together.
Was it hard for you to make the decision to go back to work? Obviously, I think you loved the international job that you had and you must have been thinking about it, but how old were your kids and how'd that go with your husband and all that?
These are all really private choices. So there's no rights or wrongs. And I kind of have a personal philosophy that being a mother, there is guilt there. You're going to encounter guilt at some point. And the job is actually to do your best and try not to let yourself ever get bogged down in, did I make the right choice or am I making the right choice? Because so many paths can overload you with a sense of responsibility. And so I would say there's no rights or wrongs in a way. But I decided when I had my first child, I couldn't really face working full time in London with a baby. I really wanted to be with her. So that was why I went to Botswana with my husband. But then once I was there, I had my second baby. She's 18 months younger than the first. So I was at home for 3 years altogether, which was wonderful and absolutely loved it. But for sort of financial reasons and onward career reasons, I felt I needed to at least go back to work part time. Through Mum Network. So I just heard about a company looking for a lawyer and really keen to have a sort of British lawyer. So I worked part-time and I did that for about 4 or 5 years. And then once they were both school age, I would say the much harder decision was to move back to the UK, go back to the Foreign Office and work full-time in London with school-age children.
But you also went to South Africa, right? Was that after?
It's complicated, yeah. So I did 2 years like that in London. And then, but a lot of support from family because I moved near my parents. But then I felt I wanted to, my husband's career was still in Africa, so he was commuting.
Oh dear.
We went back to South Africa, so to make it slightly easier to bring the family together.
We did that for a while. My husband's career was in, the office was in Dubai, and I was in California. Gosh, and yeah. I was like, I'm going to be here. And he went back and forth for 4 years before we moved here.
Yeah, it's really hard, isn't it?
So your decision to go back to work when you had school-age kids, why was that hard?
I was very lucky in the sense that I was in Botswana, a place I knew well. I had help at home, which we wouldn't necessarily have in Europe in the same way.
For sure.
So I had trusted people to help and be around. And it was only going to be part-time. And the town is small, so I could get around really quickly. But I could literally drop one at school and the other one in a nursery across from the office. I'd be at the office and then pick them up by lunchtime. So it was okay. But it was still hard for me because me personally, I wanted to be around for every nappy change and be the one who really took care of them. But actually, they really prospered by having that kind of morning routine of nurseries and school and so on. They really loved it. They have a lot of friends even relate to that time. So I guess it was positive to have a balance and it was probably good for me. I remember the first time someone brought me a cup of tea in the office and had my own desk.
And it was hot and you got to drink the whole thing.
I was like, wow, this is just after several years of changing nappies and balancing a drink in one hand while you're breastfeeding or something. It was a kind of emotional moment.
I'm nodding because I remember the first time I got into my car without my son to go to work. And I was like, where's my ball and chain? Yeah. And then you sit down and you drink a hot coffee and it's hot the whole time. And I don't know. I think it's hard if you're used to doing a lot of stuff to just not do a lot of stuff, or you do a lot of stuff, but it doesn't go anywhere. Sometimes I feel like I walk laps around the kitchen. Mm. What am I doing?
Yeah.
I want to ask you about South Africa and schools. How did you pick the school? Was that stressful? Did the Foreign Office tell you this is the school that your kids are going to go to? Or Tell me about that. Also, you mentioned that you have a neurodiverse daughter, which I have a neurodiverse son, and it really complicated the school thing for us here in Luxembourg.
Yeah, I think going back to what I said earlier about Pretoria, I think that was the hardest move because the kids had school age needs. They were sort of 7 and 8 by the time we moved. That's a busy time in a sort of school kid's life where they've got to have friends, they go to parties, they have all their sports. You're trying to really help them master the sort of basics of the academic stuff. I put them into a school that did an English syllabus, and I decided to prioritize that above other things like their sports facilities or things like that. But the school just wasn't right for us, and that was really hard. So I felt we lost a term.
How did you find out that the school wasn't right for you?
This being South Africa, it was just so different. They had a very different sort of approach to kind of safety things. Put all the kids on the back of the pickup to just go down the road to the other school. You'd never expect it. They seemed a really proper organized school, but they had certain sort of different approaches to things that a UK mother
would freak out about.
Yeah. So I put them into a South African school, but more structured, and they thrived better there and a lot better facilities. And even though they had to learn a bit of Afrikaans, they dealt with that and thrived in the overall kind of more structured kind of school environment, I think. I think this is one of the big things about being a parent is what works for one doesn't always work for the other.
100%.
And just where you think you're getting it right with one, you find that it's definitely not coming right with the other.
That actually brings me to a question about you and your real world embassing diplomat work. How does being a parent to a neurodiverse kid affect your advocacy in the global real world stage?
Actually, I think everything that you go through in life shapes your values. The UK has values that I can align with. It's part of what I was talking about earlier about serving, I think, is you also have to do the job in a way that is true to the values of the country you're representing and true to your personal values. And I think the UK are making real progress on some of the areas that I hold dear and that I'm trying to champion and be part of here. So if there's ever an opportunity to talk about neurodiversity, I'm not an expert in it, but I'm always really interested to share my experiences and understand other people's. And the same with LGBTQ plus issues, because actually sometimes there's a lot of connection. All of this opens your mind to what real people are experiencing. As we were talking about before, politics is society. Society is made of people, and people are fascinating. And the more you can understand them, the more you can understand each other, understand yourself, the more you can have real relationships that change the world. And I constantly struggle, I think, and I want to be part of the solution to those who went before us who were very closed-minded, or a society that was designed for a certain type of people. And the modern society is going to needs a big shake-up and need to be part of that and part of the vanguard of that, not just leave it to the youngsters to have to drive that forward. So
I love that. Is that what you say in your job interview when you want the Luxembourg position?
You do talk about values, but yeah, that's not the only thing you say. Yeah, sure.
We should probably talk about what your goals are for this position.
Yeah. I have a lot of ambition for this relationship. I think the UK-Luxembourg relationship is already a really good one. We are very like-minded international partners in all sorts of ways, and we have a very close alliance economically through our connected financial centres. My priorities and goals really are to ensure that I do everything I can to help build on that economic and financial centre-based sort of relationship to make sure that grows from strength to strength. We also have a very close relationship on wider security and defense issues. So working closely with Luxembourg on defense and the sort of partnership that we have to have across the world in NATO, but more broadly, and on the commercial elements around that too. But then also the innovation side. This is where I said before, I think Luxembourg is really interesting. So what's happening in the future here is we've got a massive and interest in satellites, which is really exciting and fits with UK priorities. And also AI is going to overtake us all. I'm sure Luxembourg is going to be at the forefront of European innovation on AI. So definitely something to be involved with.
What are some of the British, Luxembourgish companies that you want to highlight as doing a good job bringing you towards your goals?
All the British community organizations I have strong links with and really enjoy that. So of course, the British Chamber of Commerce, if you're linked to a British company here, to have a seat at the organization's events that BCC do is a really powerful thing. They're a great, very energetic, dynamic group of people.
Do you have to be British to be a member of that, or English speaking?
It's British companies or companies with British interests. But when I go there, I feel it's a very international group of people, actually, but with some British interests. And it's a massive group of people. They do really good events all through the year, 30, 40 events on kind of hot topics, women and gender finance, space, all sorts of things. Really interesting group of people. So that's kind of the business side. Obviously, the British Ladies Club. We have the British Luxembourg Society. So lots of expats here join up for that. And they also run a lot of events, really lively group of people. So that's really interesting. There are alumni groups of big universities like Cambridge, Oxford, and the LSE.
Here. Luxembourg is a pretty small country. Are there a lot of alumni?
Yeah.
Really?
From the Prime Minister down.
So
Prime Minister from Cambridge.
This goes with my everyone here is an overachiever theme. So maybe I'm misspoken.
Yeah.
What's your pitch to a trailing spouse who finds herself here, given the great relationship between if they're British or Luxembourgish or even maybe English speaking, about getting involved in some of these things?
That's a tricky one, but depending on where people come from. Obviously, the whole of Europe's borders are digitalized now and getting a bit firmer. Going back and forth isn't always as easy. Access for professional services is not as easy. Firstly, I would say if they're a lady trailing spouse, I would, and have any kind of British connection, I would seriously suggest they sign up for and join in with the British Ladies Club of Luxembourg, which is a really active club that's growing quite a bit. Amy Gresh, the current president, is very much embracing the fact that there is a very diverse body of English-speaking women that are here in Luxembourg. And she's doing great things for not just the sort of the traditional things that the club's always done for its members, which is around networking and community, but also she's doing innovative things like helping women with startups.
I didn't know. That's so cool. I actually joined the British Ladies Club before I joined the American Women's Club. One of the common themes that I have seen is you have to join stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
For a lot of my friends that are British that are here, Brexit was like a huge deal. They were scrambling. My sister-in-laws are British now, but they're Italian, but they were living there their whole life. There was like this scramble. How does Brexit affect your job, your day-to-day here?
At this point in time, predecessors probably were having to deal with the technicalities of the people living here and the arrangements for them, the actual going through the moment of Brexit, which was felt like a rupture for a lot of people out here. And there was a lot of emotion and a lot of tricky political negotiations ongoing. But at this point in time, this government came in, and I've come in months later from the UK government coming in, with a real priority to have a close relationship with all the member states of the EU and to a better relationship with the EU itself. So at kind of quite a nice time to be here post-Brexit, where I'm seeing our negotiations sorting out more and more of the ongoing sort of final kind of complications and issues, and us basically rewriting the legal relationship between us and the EU, but enabling taking down big obstacles to trade. We've had some good announcements on future for youth mobility in for example, us rejoining Erasmus.
I heard about that.
There are still negotiations ongoing, and we'll have another summit this year. And so we'll probably hear a bit more about where those get to. But to be honest, in many ways, the relationship with the EU, between the UK and the EU, is being worked on and improved over time. So I suppose how it affects me is to keep up with understanding which are the live issues, where things are going, but also just generally to understand now the EU makes decisions for itself and understanding how they affect the UK and ensuring that people understand that.
But what does that mean? The EU didn't make decisions for themselves before?
No, they did without having to think of the UK interest necessarily.
I see.
So how you play back in, just remember you trade with us to a huge extent, or how we manage some of those kind of complicating issues going forward, not just from the Brexit deal itself. It's our ongoing relationship needs work and tending, and we do that.
So it sounds like you guys broke up and then maybe they were kind of mad, but now you're back together in co-parenting very functional way.
Europe is our home. So when we broke up, we never moved. We never moved out. UK is Europe, and we never chose to leave Europe. We just didn't want to be as tightly held in the EU club, if you like, because of our own national interests. However, that doesn't change our geography. It doesn't also change, to be honest, the fact that we have a huge trading relationship. And it definitely doesn't change the fact that we have common security and defense priorities that we can only face together. And I think with what's going on in the world and the sort of geopolitical turmoil that we're seeing, that relationship between the UK and Europe, including Luxembourg very much, has demonstrably strengthened as we all face the same priority.
And the same rupture. You can say it.
The geopolitical world is shifting, and there's no question about that.
So actually, I was thinking about, would you ever un-Brexit? Then I read an opinion piece in the Financial Times this morning about saying that maybe they would un-Brexit. It was an opinion piece.
This government's very clear that we'll never rejoin the European Union. But what we are doing is ensuring that we have a close relationship with the EU, and that works and functions and meets both our needs, which are pretty reciprocal in lots of ways. No, it's not on the table. We're not planning to rejoin the table as a member state.
So you're never going to rejoin the EU, but all the functioning things are still full speed ahead, like Erasmus and trade and sticking together for security and stuff like that.
Key things that both countries need, we have to work together on. it is happening and it is there, absolutely. But that doesn't mean the same thing as having a customs union or free movement. And mm-hmm. those are the big ticket items that we don't plan to rejoin.
But what about Erasmus?
It's a type of youth scheme, isn't it? That we have actually with lots of countries outside of the EU as well. We have schemes where we can encourage our youth to go to other people's universities, them to come to us, because that's about opportunities for all our youngsters to fulfill the potential to increase the amount of children who get the right, or I would say actually young people who get the right access to the institutions where they can do tech or science or whatever they need to do.
And also world peace, not to just crazy, but I think that if you made every kid study abroad, the incidence of war would go down.
Because
if you learn when you're a little kid how to get along with another culture, think about that. If everybody had to do that, what our world would look like.
Yeah, totally. And I think there's always a moment, I think, where you've been in another country and that country and you've read their news and you've spoken perhaps to that people in that society or even those leaders, if you happen to be an ambassador or diplomat. And then you see how it's portrayed in someone else's media and you realize, people haven't understood. They don't get that. And that's quite an eye-opening moment when you realize there's a how things look from the outside, how media portray things is not always what's really going on.
Of course. Of course. Yeah, I had a fascinating discussion with my 8-year-old. He was like, who's on our team and who isn't on our team and who wasn't on our team when we were talking about World War II? And I was like, Germany wasn't on our team. But like now they're on our team. He's like, okay, who's not on our team? And I was like, Iran? China, maybe? I don't know. And he was like, but my uncle is from Iran. Like he has to be on our team. And so that's just a perfect example of people.
It's complicated.
People, not politics, really.
Yeah, and it's not with the societies, but it's their leadership at that time may have malign intent.
Yeah.
But it's not the people themselves necessarily.
Yeah.
There's lots of nuance and complication in there too.
Speaking of security, me personally as a citizen, I was really impressed with Europe sticking together about the Greenland thing. But Luxembourg, it's just a really small country. So I wish that they could maybe have a bigger voice and people would listen. But do you feel like sometimes they just kind of have to go along with what France and Germany say because they're just small?
Luxembourg is one of the EU member states and a NATO founding member. So it has a voice, definitely has a voice. We all have a voice, but it's how we use it. There are moments to stand up and call things out. There are also moments in diplomacy where sometimes dealing with things that are difficult have to be done in a sort of not a rhetoric loud thing in the media, but in private. And in our messaging, through speeches, through telephone calls between leaders and so on, this is how we reduce the sort of the anger, the emotion out of it, all the sort of rhetoric from it. And we actually get to the real business. We understand each other's positions and we try and work through them. That's diplomacy. So I'm not going to say that I think Luxembourg is very effective and probably more effective than you would ever realize. And not least because it actually is a economically very strong state, an important state to Europe. And it has incredibly, it really understands Europe in a way that not everybody does. So it's right there in the center of things, hosts many of the EU institutions. I think Luxembourg has a pretty good voice.
I love that. It makes me glad to hear.
But I also think more happens behind the scenes than people always realize. In some cases, especially with allies, that's the most important place for the speeches to happen or the talks to happen.
That's so cool. That makes me proud to live here. Anything else before we go that you would like to tell the English-speaking community of Luxembourg?
I really enjoy when I do meet the community. It's fantastic. I'm always looking for opportunities to do that. So I'm really grateful for all the kind of offers I've had and the communities I've got involved with. And I keep discovering more and more bits of the community who are out there clubbing together, whether they're playing cricket together or have a gardening club together or whatever it is. So that's really interesting to me. And also I learn from people living here who often are married to Luxembourgers or other international people. You just get a real understanding of the life, sometimes not even in Luxembourg City, but it's great to get outside the city and understand the life here. So really looking forward to meeting people, always happy to be invited to things. I'm not really the belle of the ball, honestly. There are plenty of diplomatic invites, but not as many as you'd think. So do let me know if there's something I can do or attend that would highlight your event.
I definitely will. That reminds me. Have you heard of Home From Home?
Yes, I've been there. Yes.
Do they have everything you need? Do they have Tetley?
They actually do. They have everything. And they have even helped me when I decided to do a really kind of Fortnum & Mason type of tea.
Nice.
A high tea. They bake the scones and something else, a Victoria sponge as well, I think. And they did it brilliantly. So yeah.
No, they have amazing cakes there.
Yeah,
they really
lovely
do.
Lovely cakes.
Yeah. And best British pub in town that you're not being paid to endorse?
I think I'd have to say the Britannia.
Really?
Mainly because they have been such great supporters of UK interests. They always come and take a poppy tin to that time of year where we do Remembrance Sunday, and they take one of our collecting tins and they collect down at the pub there amongst British people and bring back the tin with money. So I'm really grateful to them for keeping the faith and being part of that. and it's got the name Britannia. So
there you go. Rule Britannia. Okay. Ambassador Olivier, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's a wrap on this episode of Mom Life in Luxembourg. If you like the show, I'd love to hear from you. Please feel free to leave a comment, or better yet, share with another mom friend. And if there's a topic you'd like to see covered or you want to be on the show yourself, please email me at momlife@rtl.lu. And if you're feeling social, you can always reach me on Facebook and Instagram at Mom Life in Luxembourg. Thanks so much and have a great day.